Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
And welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday here on News Talk 580 KMJ. And remember, it's always online at KMJ580.com worldwide. We visit with another Valley veteran of World War II today, and you can see him in person next week if you go out to the concert of the Sounds of Freedom Band. That's the Association of the U.S. Army, the local branch Sounds of Freedom Military Band. A spring concert coming up next Sunday. That's April the 20th at 2 o'clock at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building, which of course is at 5th and Hughes in Old Town Clovis. I highly recommend it. It's a motivational, inspirational, and entertaining time anytime you're around the Sounds of Freedom Band, especially if you have a chance to chat with Holland Kenny, who is the lead trumpeter for Sounds of Freedom Band. So how old do you guess Mr. Kenny would be? 70? 75? 80? 85? Well, he's here. So, Mr. Kenny, how old are you?
Well, I'll be 90 in September.
And how long have you been with the band now?
Well, I helped start this band somewhere around between 1983 and 85. I can't remember exactly. And I've been with them, of course, since then. And
you've been playing the trumpet for...
I directed the band about, well, more than half the time. When a director would either die or leave or quit, I took over.
They know you're up to the challenge.
Yeah.
And you started playing the trumpet way back on the west side in Dos Palos as what, a 12-year-old?
13 years old.
13.
I went in seventh grade in Dos Palos.
So you've been playing the trumpet for more than 75 years?
Yes, yes.
You must have some pretty strong lips.
No, not really. They should be better than they are. They're getting a little old, I think, maybe. A little mellow.
We'll play a song for you in a little bit, and you'll hear a sampling of Holland Kenny's work with the Sounds of Freedom Band, and maybe a song from the World War II era that might be appropriate to our guest today. Now, you grew up in Dos Palos, and you actually went in the service before World War II started, is that right?
No, I didn't go into. I was married at the time when the war started in 41, and I went in the spring of, or in March of 43.
You obviously got out of high school before World War II started. 1936, you graduated?
I graduated in 1936, yes.
Well, and being a Los Banos guy myself, and you're from Dos Palos, that football rivalry is about as intense as any in the Valley. How did the Broncos do against Los Banos when you were in school?
When I was in school, they didn't do very well. Los Banos was they seemed to always take over, but I remember in 1937, we won a game from Los Banos, and I remember the score, 16-6.
And where were you?
I was just out of high school at that for the...
You were at the game.
I was at the game. Yes, I was.
And that meant a lot to finally...
Yes.
And as a true Bronco, the shirt he's wearing as we talk here today is blue and gold, but it's actually an Airborne Troop Carrier alumni shirt, and we'll talk about the duties that he had during World War II. And, you know, I covered high school football here for about 10 years. Not once have my Los Banos Tigers beaten the Dos Palos Broncos, so your hometown has had bragging rights for quite a while now after finally getting that win in 1937 that you remember so well. So you're married, the war hits, and did you choose to go to the Army Air Corps, or tell us about that process of getting into the military and what went through your mind?
No, I was drafted, actually, and I was working for N.M. Balsons here in Fresno, and we were building the runways. In fact, I was in charge of curing the runway, the concrete runway in Hammer Field, and I worked on the siphon tube up at the Fryant Dam. And then we were building, just completed the airport in Fairfield, and I got my draft notice. And of course, I went to Monterey and got my clothing and my instructions, and then I was shipped to St. Louis, where I went to Jefferson Barracks for my basic training. And the basic training, I believe, was kind of rough. It was for combat engineers. And when I finished the basic training, got out, and they sent me out on the machine gun range to train for overseas, and While I was gone, it seemed like they had an alert and my outfit shipped out, and I went back to Jefferson Barracks. I was a casual, and boy, was I thankful. I really didn't want to go to the combat engineers, but I would have.
So your leave was timed at the right time.
Perfect. And then they put me in the Army Air Corps, and I went in with a troop carrier.
You ever look back and wonder how your life would have been different if you had been there when they shipped up?
Very possibly you wouldn't be here. That's a pretty dangerous assignment. That's why I didn't want to go.
Well, somebody was looking out for you.
Yeah, the engineers kind of went in and laid the groundwork for the combat troops. So I went into the troop carrier command, and that was really a good thing for me. It wasn't that rough like some of the falls. I don't like to brag about my experiences over there so much because although I was in harm's way, I didn't have to dig foxholes and shoot people. So I was very fortunate there. I served in other ways.
Well, we're going to talk about all the ways that you served, but on that note, that's the one thing, and I don't want to lump you in together with every other World War II veteran, but if there's a common theme with the hundreds of World War II veterans that I've talked to, it's that you all share that perspective of, you know, what I went through wasn't so bad. There were guys that had it worse. And I'll talk to guys who were on the Bataan Death March, and they'll still say that there were other guys that had it worse, that the guys who didn't come home are the real heroes, and they're just thankful to be here. And I can hear that in what you're saying, that you're thankful that things worked out exactly the way you have. And what a twist of fate to miss out on shipping out with those guys and get the assignment that you got. The assignment that you were given by the Army Air Corps with the Troop Carrier Command, what did that entail? What kind of things were you up to?
Well, we were under the 9th Air Force, 53rd Wing, 434th Group, and I was in the 72nd Squadron. There were probably about 350 of us in a squadron. And I was in a ground crew, a motor pool, mostly. We had the C-47s, our civilian were DC-3s.
A big airplane.
Yeah, at that time it was large, yes.
And, nowadays it looks like a pea.
And it was an old workhorse, of course. And we carried paratroopers, dropped paratroopers. We pulled the gliders for the combat gliders. And, of course, hauled supplies and wounded and everything else in the airplanes.
What was your station on that C-47?
Well, I didn't fly. I did a lot of flying, but not combat flying. I was ground crew.
Ground crew.
And but I did a lot of riding gliders, lots of riding, because they would train young fellows, probably 18, 20, 22 maybe, just to get an airplane off the ground or a glider down or whatever here in Stateside. And they're really amateurs and young kids, and send them over to England. And then they had to finish their training. And so for a year or more, We shot landings with gliders, and I used to ride all the gliders on just about all of them, and had a lot of close calls there, but it was exciting.
Well, we'll have to talk about some of those here, and I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize. And, you know, you look at World War II, and there's so many elements of it where the people who were doing these things were really pioneers. A lot of these things had never been done before, never been attempted before. No one knew what was going to happen. But that said, there were a lot of efforts to simulate what was going to take place and to mirror as closely as they could how it was going to play out. And you were involved in some of that as you're sharing, practicing with these gliders.
Right.
Did you think at the time that this is nuts to be sending guys in to have gliders pulled by C-47s and dropping paratroopers all over Europe?
Not at all. I was never nervous. And one that, when we were landing, I'm standing up right behind the pilot, and I looked up and I said, you know, you better pull up. There's trees. We were heading for some tall trees. So he pulled up. Well, he was really a green glider pilot. He pulled up, missed the trees, but from there we went straight down. Half of the glider went one way, half the other. I never even got nervous over that. We just kind of laughed at it. I said, well, this is one glider won't fly in the invasion.
Well, that sounds a little scary there. You say you went straight down and one part of the glider went one way. Did you have to bail out? What happened?
No. I just got down on my knees and hung on. Gliders are pretty light. You know, they're tubing and fabric, but they would haul quite a payload. In fact, they wouldn't fly without a payload. We had to load sacks of sands and our people in to make them fly.
This sounds like it might have been a rough landing, though.
Yes, it was very rough. I was lucky, very lucky. I just had a few bruises. But they would haul a Jeep or a cannon or 12 fully packed soldiers. So it's a pretty good-sized glider. There were only two gliders made. The one, made here in Waco, Texas, I believe it was. It's a CG-4A.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other glider made in for World War II was called a Horsa glider, and that was made in England. It was a little larger than our glider, but it was made of plywood, and ours was just fabric and tubing. So there was a little difference there, but ours was really a better flying glider, but didn't carry quite as much payload.
But there's still only so much you can do in a glider. After the C-47 has let you go.
You asked me if I were nervous around a glider. You know, one pilot came out one day out on the runway, and he said, I've got permission to take this glider up to 10,000 feet and see if I can loop it five times in the first 1,000 feet or 5,000 feet.
Uh-huh.
And it's just an experiment. We don't know whether the glider will handle this or not. We want to find out, so we need volunteers for ballast. But you have to have your parachutes. So I took a run for the shack to get my parachute. And
you mean you volunteered for
that? Oh, absolutely. I want to go so bad, and by the time I got back, they were full. Someone beat me to it. So they pulled up that glider up 10,000 feet and leveled off at 5,000. They had looped five times.
So they pulled
it
off.
So they were pretty sturdy.
And here you were breaking the first rule of being in the Army. You were volunteering. You're never supposed to do that.
You're right.
But you didn't quite make it.
Well, that was something kind of exciting, you know, for young people. You know, you're involved. You're not going to die, right? Not when you're young, but when you get older, then you worry about it.
Uh-huh. Well, there are lots more stories like that to come. We need to take our first commercial break right now. When we come back, more with Holland Kinney, a World War II veteran who is still playing lead trumpet in the Sounds of Freedom Band, which you can hear next Sunday in Clovis. More on that when we come back. You're listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Bye.
Sure you all recognize Wild Blue Yonder, performed by the Association of the United States Army Sounds of Freedom Band, which will be performing next Sunday at 2 o'clock at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building. That's at 5th and Hughes in the city of Clovis, Old Town Clovis. And the lead trumpeter on that recording is sitting with us right now, Holland Kinney, from Dos Palos originally, been in Fresno for quite a long time now, and was serving in the U.S. Army Air Corps during World War II. In fact, he even had a chance to hone those trumpeting skills during the war. When did you, and was that something when you shipped out that you said, I better take my horn with me, I better have that trumpet to keep me occupied?
I decided I wanted my trumpet with me, so I stuck in the middle of my barracks bag. You know, we had that one bag. We had carried all your belongings the whole time that we served.
Some and, other guys had so, pictures of Betty Grable or...
Yeah, no, I took my trumpet out of the case and put it in the middle of the bag and packed all of my clothing around it to protect it, and that's the way I carried it for my 2.5 years of overseas service.
Were you ever worried that somebody else might play a trick on you and it would disappear from that bag?
No, because your barracks bag stayed pretty close with you. When it wasn't with you, it was near some of your buddies, and we looked after each other. And believe me, we were family in our group, and all groups, I think, were that way, because it was a pretty serious life that we led. But I packed the trumpet in there, and I got overseas, and somebody heard that I had the trumpet, and they had me play a little bit in the barracks, and then I found out though some fellows had formed a group of good musicians that had been drafted, and they formed this band, and so they asked me to play in, which I did. And this General Brereton was head of the troop carrier command at that time, and he heard the band fooling around one time, and he said, boy, that's good. And he said, you know, we need this for our troops over here. We have in England, you know, we just took over England with troops after World War started.
Oh yeah.
They needed entertainment because we weren't really fighting at that time. We were just dodging bombs and so forth, worrying about the infiltration of spies and whatever. He said we need this band really bad, so he let us go ahead and play at different Army parties and Army officers and enlisted men both, and we played some pretty nice places in England, but we were out 7 nights a week And he said, you can't do that because we got a war to fight, you know. That's too much. So he said, I'll let you play four nights and we'll play extracurricular pay for it.
Well, you can't beat that.
No. So after our duties, the training was over during the day and in the evening, they transfer me out of the Air Corps into the special services, and we go on and do our job, and wherever it was, if, whether we flew somewhere or drove somewhere. And
so you were traveling back, just to perform.
Right. And then back, you know, like midnight, we'd transfer me back into troop care, and at 6 o'clock, I'm up again with on my duties. So we played a lot of nice places in England. We had a nine-piece band. We played all the big band music. And we played the Rainbow Ballroom in London every month. So it was a very good experience. As a matter of fact, when we got over France, after we got to, invaded France and got settled in, we even went to Riviera and played for a week for the officers' rehabilitation program. So besides fighting the war, I had a lot of fun.
What did your wife think about all that? Did you write her home about that? Because I'm sure, you know, musicians in Europe are pretty popular guys.
Unfortunately, my wife really didn't wait for me. She fell in love with some pilot out here at Eagle Field. When I got home, I didn't go back with her. We talked. Yeah, and she fell in love with this officer. And after the war, he went back to his wife.
Amazing what the war will do to people.
Oh, yeah. It was hard on the families. It really was. I realize that. And it was very difficult for me. That incident really broke me up. But I got over it.
Well, it sounds like you had no choice. And I'm curious about the band in Europe as we get back to happier topics here. I'm thinking, just off the top of my head, there are probably some other veterans listening. It may be very possible that one of the veterans in our listening audience maybe heard you play in England or in France. Wouldn't that be a small world? Did you guys have a name for your band? What did you go by when you're out there performing?
Yes, let me think. That's a long
it's
time.
It's been a while. It's been more than 60 years.
I'll probably think of it before.
We'll revisit that. But along this time, you're here playing music in England, not knowing when you're going to have to go across to France. And at some point, there was talk of you having to go to the Pacific?
Well, I'll go back a little bit. I went overseas on the Queen Mary, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
We have one other lady member in our band, and her father went over on the Queen Mary, so that's kind of a coincidence.
In the Sounds of Freedom band here locally, you're talking
yes.
about.
Yes.
Right. And that band, by the way, for those of you who haven't seen Sounds of Freedom perform, and you can do that Sunday at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building, that's next Sunday, the 20th at 2 o'clock. That's one thing that impresses me. Here you are on lead trumpet. You're going to be 90 in September. There's another trumpet player in the band who's a teenager who's got three generations of his family in the band, or at least two of them. And you see young and old united by that patriotism and that love for our country. And it really comes out in the performance, and that's one thing that strikes me. So one of the members of your band, her father went over on the Queen Mary.
Right.
Did you leave from New York?
Or and
where'd
another
you ship
one's
out?
Father was in a baton walk.
Mm-hmm.
Death March. Excuse me.
There's so many experiences that come together, I'm sure, when you get together to play all your music.
Yeah, but after the Germany surrendered, I have to tell you a little story about Germany surrendering. Just before the surrender, I had a crew of men out loading gasoline in Jeep cans into a C-47 to haul to Patton. And he was nearing Berlin at the time. And they had a rush on flying some gasoline into them. So I had this crew out on the airfield in France. And all of a sudden, I have a tracer bullet come right over, flying over my head. And I ducked it. And then I heard ammunition flying around and up and down the runway. And I called in. I had a field phone. I called in the headquarters and asked them what's going on. I said, yeah, I thought maybe Germany had turned around and I didn't think it was possible because we had them whipped at that time. And I thought we became on a defensive status. And they said, oh, no. They said, what happens? Germany surrendered. And the guys, everyone around, we were based with all the paratroopers. And all the paratroopers are celebrating here. They're firing everything they can get their hands on. And they're firing out on a runway because they don't think anyone's out there. Well, I had a crew of men loading C-47s with 5 gallons of Jeep cans. So it was friendly fire. Friendly fire almost got me. It was a very close call because the stuff was really flying around there. So I said, well, fine, I'll dismiss my crew and come in. No, you can't do that. We radioed Patton, and he says, yeah, I heard that Germany surrendered, but he says, I haven't seen it in writing yet, so keep that gas coming. So I think within a couple of hours, well, they had it all settled, and we got out of there, and the MPs had to collect all the firearms in the whole camp, thousands of firearms they had to collect for their own
safety.
For everyone's safety. As a matter of fact, I heard even a couple of fellows did get killed out there that night from all the celebrating. And so that was quite an experience. I thought, due to Patton, that brave man out there almost killed one of his own men here. But because of his stubbornness, and he was stubborn, I think the record shows that. But
absolutely.
Anyway, after the Germany surrendered, then when they sent us home and gave us a 30-day rehabilitation leave, and then we were to go to South Pacific and win that war for them over there. Well, while I was on my rehab, they dropped a bomb, and I got out. And that was another lucky break in my career.
I know there are a lot of men who served during World War II who feel the same way, that you know they were scheduled to participate in the invasion of Japan, whether they be Marines who were going to be going ashore, someone in your position, and those bombs, for all the lives that they took, saved exponentially more lives in the long run. In fact, there are a lot of people that look back and say, America should have dropped the bomb earlier, and maybe lives would have been saved on Okinawa, places like that.
But, I believe it, yes.
I guess hindsight's 20/20.
Yes.
Right?
Well, I have a lot of that.
Well, I know you have a lot of good stories, too. Let's catch another commercial when we come back. More of the musical experiences, the wartime experiences of Holland Kinney, a World War II veteran who is our guest this week. You're listening to Hometown Heroes once again on News Talk 580 KMJ.
It's hard.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
That, of course, the Andrews Sisters with Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, and I guess that applies to our guest today, Holland Kinney, who you can hear him play his trumpet Sunday at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building with the Sounds of Freedom Band. That's a free concert, 2 o'clock, open to the public. You'll hear lots of patriotic and military music, and I'll tell you, I have been privileged to spend some time with the band in the past, and you will not regret going to that concert next Sunday at 2 o'clock. We continue now with Holland Kinney, who's going to be 90 years old in September. And how long are you going to keep playing the trumpet with the Sounds of Freedom Band?
As long as my chops last.
And they're holding up pretty good.
Well, pretty good.
Still hit those high notes.
Well, I can't play quite as high as I used to, maybe, but I'm close.
Can you still handle reveille?
But I play, oh, yes. Oh, yes.
That's as high as you need to go. If you can do reveille. Well, we were talking about your time in the service in the U.S. Army Air Corps, part of the Troop Carrier Command during World War II, and one of the things that you got to do as an extracurricular activity was travel all over Europe entertaining the troops with your band. And at one point, that actually became the subject of a newsreel, and folks that were alive back then, I wasn't, but I've seen pictures and heard their stories, that when you go to the movies at the theater, before the main feature comes on, you see the newsreel footage. And one of those crews came out to film your band at the Rainbow Ballroom.
In London.
What was that like? Did you feel like a movie star?
Yes, we were very proud of that. We looked forward to that session. Of course, we knew ahead of time that they were going to do it.
You hit all the notes?
I think so. They're a pretty good little group. We played some good music.
And you never got to see the finished product, though, what they put together.
No, I wish I could. Now that you mention it, I'm going to have to get on my computer and see if I can find it in the record somewhere, historical record somewhere, maybe.
Well, there might be an archive. I imagine there is an archive. We might be able to track that down, and you could see
news.
It. Mm-hmm. 65 years later, you might be able to see it. That would be something.
Yeah, interesting, wouldn't it?
But you did hear one of your band members' wives was able to see it in a theater back in the States?
Yes, and she sent copies of the still shots of the film.
I know you had other excitement besides that. Those were some of the lighthearted moments, some of the happy moments. And while we're on that topic, before we get to some more serious stuff, what did it mean to you? Obviously, you had moments where your life was in danger, but you knew that a lot of these guys were out there on the front lines, and here are the guys that you're entertaining, and they need a little R&R before they go back out there the next day or the next week or whatever. What did that mean to you, to be able to give them a little entertainment and a little respite from what they were facing?
Well, I felt very proud that we could do that. There were nine of us in this group, and we all felt the same way about it. We had great, serious feelings about these people that you know, we knew we were going to fly over and maybe not come back. And before we're through, I want to tell you one that's very interesting about my outfit. Whenever you're ready for
it. Feel free. Hammer away. I think we're all listening.
I told you a few minutes ago when I lost my wife and remarried in 1992 in August, and it'll be 16 years this August that we've been married. But right after we were married, with the first reunion that we went to of my outfit, it was in Phoenix. And my wife went up to one of the pilots in the outfit, and she said, "You know," said, "I had a cousin that was in troop carrier, but I don't know which one." She said, "Does anyone here know a Keith Burtkin?" And he said, "Oh, my God, yes. He was one of our favorite pilots." Well, as it turned out, Keith Burtkin was one of the early pilots in the invasion to fly over Holland, and he was shot down. At the reunion, his radio man, who was riding with him and bailed out, and both his wingmen, was the commander of the troop carrier and one of the other pilots, the wingmen.
So he was a C-47 pilot.
C-47 pilot. Mm-hmm. When he got hit by the radio man and the crew chief, got the paratroopers out because they were loaded, and got the paratroopers all out of the ship, and the crew chief, and then the radio man called the co-pilot to try to get him out. Well, he got picked up the wrong parachute, and when he went out, he went one way and the parachute went the other, so they lost him. Mm. And of course the pilot, who turned out to be my new wife's cousin, and what she was able to tell the other pilots that were left, the radio man and the two wingmen that saw him go down in flames, she was able to tell them that when he crashed, a Hollander went out and buried his body and kept dog tags until the war was over, and then he sent the dog tags to our government. Well, in 1948, our government went back to Holland, and they
were able to exhume the body?
Yeah. Excuse me.
Obviously, this is a very emotional story. It's you, as you yeah. see it through your wife's eyes and what that meant to her.
Well, to her and to all the pilots. To know that Keith was returned home. He's buried out here at Liberty Cemetery.
So none of those guys ever knew, the guys who served with him never knew what happened to him?
All they knew is he went down.
Mm-hmm.
And he was, but anyway, he, and my wife, of course, went to his funeral in 1948. So this is quite ironic that after all these years, she was able to clear this up for his pilot.
But and if she hadn't married you,
never would have known.
She never would have been at that reunion to be able to tell him.
None of our pilots would ever known what happened to Keith.
That is.
I didn't know. I didn't know when I married her. I didn't know that her cousin was in my outfit overseas.
Mm-hmm. What a small world.
I get kind of emotional about this.
Oh, I don't blame you. That's incredible, and it kind of shoots down those people that say everything happens by accident.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like an accident.
Keith is I got to think about this now. VFW hall in the mountain town, Mariposa.
Mm-hmm.
Mariposa VFW hall is the Keith Burtkin Mariposa.
It's named after him.
Hall. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he got all these pictures and all his war stories are all there.
Well, I'm going to have to go up there and take a look at that sometime, and I hope some of our listeners will too.
You do that, and that was my wife's cousin. She was at his funeral in 1948. And when we married in 1992, she was able to tell my buddies what happened
44 years later, they finally found out what happened to them. 48 to 92 would be 44.
Yeah, okay.
That's a long time to not know what happened and then to be clued in. That is amazing. There are so many great stories out there, and I know you have some more very entertaining stories to tell. Let's go ahead and catch our final commercial break right now. When we come back, I want to hear what it was like. Now, a lot of people, you know, we know what happened during World War II, and Pearl Harbor stays with us to this day and the devastation that was there. But the United States was really blessed during World War II that was really the only damage done to America. And you look at Europe and all these historic cities were just decimated by the bombing. And, you know, if you think about New York City, and we saw it on 9/11, but if it had been bombed during World War II, or Washington, D.C., or San Francisco, or L.A., or Dallas, or any of these cities that have so much that we look at, or, you know, in the Southeast, so much history down there, if any of those cities had been decimated the way European cities were, we'd be having a completely different discussion.
On that line, when I went across the channel after we invaded France and we all moved in, when I crossed the channel at Cherbourg and I looked at that beautiful city in a rubble, and I got sick to my stomach, and just to see it and know what it was before, just what you were just saying. But we didn't have we didn't have to put up with that here in this country.
We're very blessed because of it. Yeah, I'm with you. I hope that we never have to experience anything like this.
I hope Rush Limbaugh can help us out of this.
Well, somebody will. I'm not sure exactly who. I know you listen to KMJ in every vehicle
own.
So but we'll talk more along those lines, because you were in London when it was hammered by V1s and V2s, and had some very close calls there. So when we come back, we're going to discuss that as we come down the home stretch with Holland Kinney, World War II veteran, who is still playing his trumpet with the Sounds of Freedom band. We'll remind you when you can catch that band. And also, before we take this break here, another event is coming up next month, May 25th. It'll be the second annual Heroes of the Valley fundraiser for the Veterans Memorial Museum in downtown Fresno. If you've never been to the museum, you need to go. There's so much history there. It is one of the hidden treasures of the Valley. And the only fundraiser that it has all year is this Heroes of the Valley fundraiser coming up May 25th. There you go. There's so much history there. It is one of the hidden treasures of the Valley. And the only fundraiser that it has all year is this Heroes of the Valley fundraiser coming up May 25th. And on next week on Heroes, we'll tell you more about that and how you can get involved in honoring our veterans here in the Valley. If you want to buy tickets right now, you can go to heroesofthevalley.com. We'll take our final break, come back with more Hometown Heroes on 580 KMJ. And KMJ580.com on the internet 24 hours a day.
Hey!
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Man behind that trumpet music is our guest today, Holland Kinney, lead trumpeter for the Association of the United States Army Sounds of Freedom Band, which will be in concert, as I told you, next Sunday, April 20th, 2 o'clock at the Clovis Veterans Memorial Building. Admission is free. If you want to donate to the band, feel free. They do some great work around their valley, and I'm looking forward to September when I'll get to share the stage with them again at their Pageant for Patriots annual fundraiser concert. It's a great band, and I hope that you'll go see them next Sunday afternoon. Don't forget the Heroes of the Valley fundraiser coming up May 25th. More of that on next week's program. But we continue now with Holland Kinney, who's going to be 90 years old in September and continues to play that trumpet just the way he has since he was a 13-year-old boy back in Dos Palos. He played it all through World War II when he was stationed in Europe. You've heard about his close call in a glider on a test flight when they had a crash landing, and he survived that. You've heard about the close call around VE Day when some celebratory gunfire, some friendly fire, almost took his life in Europe. And he had some other close calls while being stationed in and around London. And as we alluded to before the break, American cities never felt the destruction during World War II that European cities did. And you were in London when it was attacked by V1s and V2s, these high-tech new weapons that the Germans were developing. What was that like, and what kind of destruction did you see, what kind of havoc did they wreak that you were able to witness there in London?
Well, the first one was what's called a V1 or the buzz bomb. It was mechanically operated with a propeller and a motor, and it was radio operated and timed to fly so far and cut off. And you could hear that one coming. It sounded like an old Model A Ford, I used to say. And when it would, the engine would cut out, and it would go into a glide.
And leave it to a guy who owns a Model T to say it sounded like a Model A. I noticed you didn't say it sounded like a Model T.
No.
Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
But anyway, after it, you'd hear it cut out, you knew it was going to go into a glide. You knew pretty well where it might hit, so you could run if you had to. But the V-2 was a little different. It was a rocket, and it would go, I don't know how many thousand feet in the air, straight up almost, and a high peak and back down, and it was aimed for London. And that one, when you heard it, if you heard that one go, you were lucky. If you didn't hear it go off, then you're dead, because you didn't see it or hear it until it blew up. And so I've been knocked down a few times in London, let's take out a city block nearby and so forth. But they really weren't that successful. They weren't very accurate, and they never know what part of a city they were going to blow. So they weren't really that successful. So
the V-2, on the other hand.
Well, that's the V-2 I'm talking about.
You're talking about the V-2.
Well, both of them, really. Neither one of them were that successful. The V-1, the low one, most of them, they could shoot down over the channel because they were slow. But the V-1, you couldn't even see it or
hear
it.
The V-2, with the trajectory, it was a lot more difficult.
It made us, or somewhat nearest target, but it just wasn't accurate enough and was discontinued after.
I can't imagine you were skipping around London happily-go-luckily thinking there might be a V-1 or a V-2 hitting at any moment. What was that like to live in that atmosphere where you never know when something next to you is going to blow up?
Well, it's funny when you're young, you know. It was never going to blow up on the block I was standing in. That wasn't going to happen. So that's the way you feel. Yeah, I don't know. I was never really that scared. I was sometimes, but not, you know. You're invincible when you're young and over, you know, in a wartime like that. You know what some of the fellows are going through, and you're not going through it that serious, so nothing's going to happen to you. Is that right?
So you never felt like today might be the day my number gets called?
Well, yes, but I didn't take it that serious. I will say one thing while you're talking about the music over there. I felt like, in a way, my trumpet could have saved my life because in the heat of the war, the government would replace people who are in the background more in the work over there with people from front lines. When a front line man shell shock or whatever you call, have a nervous breakdown and so forth, they'd bring him back and trade him for one. So they used to line our outfit up in the Air Corps and line them up and call them out and ship them out.
So they had to create a spot for the guy coming back from the front lines, and one of you was going to go to the front lines.
That's right. They'd switch them out, and they switched a lot of them out of my outfit. And I never got called, and I kind of think it was because of special services, because we were playing in that little band and doing so much for the troops around on the side.
Because the general liked your music.
I think, yes, he did like our music. And he was a great supporter of that group. And so I kind of think that might have saved my life. I don't know. I had nothing to do with it, of course, but the way it was.
Well, your trumpet has served you well, and I think you've served your trumpet pretty well. And I know all your bandmates in the Sounds of Freedom band will vouch for that. Another one of the duties that you had in your time in Europe is one that maybe doesn't sound too exciting, but is serious nonetheless. And I've talked to a lot of guys, whether it be in Europe or the Pacific during the war. Guard duty is a high-pressure situation. You have to be awake. You have to know if there's a password or a code and a protocol that you have to follow. You have to know that to a T, or it could cost you your life. And there are some very sensitive things that you're asked to guard. And in your case, with all these planes on the ground, there's some technology in those planes that German spies would love to get their hands on. The bomb sites on some of these bombers were top secret, supposedly top secret. You might find different arguments as to who knew what and when, but
radar.
Your duty is to protect all this, and the radar that's just coming into to play there. And I understand that you were on guard duty quite a bit. Was that a nerve-wracking assignment?
Well, there again, when you're young, you know, you don't worry so much about this. But it was a very pleasant duty, I have to admit. I just have two instances. Over in France, after we bombed them out and invaded France and freed that country up, I pulled a guard duty one night, and one of the instructions was, we're an airport that we'd just taken over. And they said, don't go into any of the buildings because they're very dangerous. So I was walking around there this one night, and it was very, very dark and very eerie and very quiet. And all of a sudden, I heard I thought it was an atomic bomb. Of course, I didn't know about atomic bombs then, but the darnest crash and the loud noise I've heard, just scared the tar. I thought the Germans had dropped a bomb. And I turn around and look, and a huge metal hangar, I mean a very, very large hangar, the whole hangar crashed. It was damaged during our invasion of when we came in.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see now and then why, said, don't go in the buildings and when you're on guard duty. The other little experience I had was kind of serious in a way, but funny in another way, but we had a new young an officer joined us, and he was trying to show off his abilities and so forth, and he used to sneak out and check on the guards at night and make sure they're doing their job, and some of the guards were pretty upset about this because, he could get shot because you can shoot a man if you think he's spying.
Well, sure.
Right. And it's dark,
and you don't know who's who.
No, pitch dark. And this one night when I was out there on all the airplanes and guarding, and I heard this little noise, and so I finally spotted the person walking around in the dark over there, sneaking around. And so I sneaked up close enough myself to see, I knew who he was. And so I got my position just right and got up behind him, and I stuck my pistol in his neck and made him identify himself. And he says, you know me. He says, I'm Lieutenant so-and-so. I said, sir, identify yourself. And I kept my pistol in his neck until he did. I made him pull out all his credentials, and I knew the man, all his credentials, and put them back. And he said, why did you make me go through all that? And I said, you don't belong out here. I said, I could have shot you, and I would be innocent. So I said, don't ever do this again to a guard. And so he didn't.
So he learned his lesson.
Yeah, well, it was scary, At first, I didn't know who it was, for sure. And then when I found out, I was really upset. And I thought, it's time to teach this man a lesson.
Well, sounds like that point got across. And
it did.
Did you happen to notice if he was doing a little laundry about 20 minutes later?
I don't doubt it, because I did my best to scare it out of him.
Well, it sounds like that point definitely got across. We have a couple minutes left in the show here. One thing that I often do with the veterans on this show is ask them. We call this show Hometown Heroes, and I know so many of you will say the real heroes are the guys who never came home, but to people in my generation, all of you who served your country, who did exactly what you were asked, you are heroes in my book, but I'm curious each time if that veteran had a hero, a guy that you served with that maybe you really looked up to or did something that you really admired. Was there someone that you walked alongside that did something that really got your attention that way, or that you really had some admiration for?
I'm sorry. I just cannot single out one man. They were all so wonderful. They all did such a beautiful job. They all took their chances as stood, and they were all collectively heroes to me. I loved every one of them, and I couldn't pick them out. I think our commanding officer was a wonderful guy. He was a kind of small, and he when he was made commanding officer of the squadron, he told his lieutenant assistant, he says, I look too young for this job. He says, how am I going to command all these people when I look just like a kid out of high school? He said, I think maybe if I grow a mustache, I'll look a little more mature. And he did.
Did it work?
I think it worked, but he was a great guy. He was admired by everyone, and I'm sorry to say that he recently died with Alzheimer's. But He was a great commander. In fact, he was one of the wingmen on my wife's cousin that was shot down.
That was a great story, too. Well, we're running out of time on the show, but thank you for sharing that, and I agree. You're all heroes, and that's why we call you the Greatest Generation. That's not just a title. It's the truth. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. We'll be back next week on News Talk 580 KMJ.
You work hard.